It is taught in school that it was one of the key events that formed the concept of a nation in the populations of Upper and Lower Canada. It was a valiant defense against the unbridled, aggressive expansion of the Americans, who believed it was their manifest destiny to control all North America. It was when the Canadians burned the White House, and even though the result was status quo antebellum, it was a victory for Canada. I'm speaking, of course, about the War of 1812. This is one of the most romanticized parts of Canadian history. I mean, look at most arguments on social media between Canadians and Americans. Usually within 10 to 15 minutes, there will be at least one mention of how Canadians burned the White House down, and that is why it is now painted white. The War of 1812 would see 35,000 men fall, whether it was in action or from disease. The peace established at the end of the war would last through until the present day and would pave the path for the largest demilitarized border between nations in the world. The war would also change and in some instances amplify perceptions of Indigenous people in British North America and the United States. The war would also create the core sentiment that would lead to the formation of the Dominion of Canada just over 50 years later. Canadian historian Charles Perry Stacey wrote the War of 1812 is one where the memories of it make everyone happy. He wrote, "The Americans think they whipped the British. Canadians think of it equally pridefully as a war of defense which their brave fathers, side by side, turned back the massed might of the United States and saved the country from conquest. And the English are happiest of all because they don't even know it happened." From the icy plains where Indigenous nations thrived long before the settlers arrived, to the battle smoke of the War of 1812, Canada's stories echo through time. We know the legends, Vimy Ridge, the birth of Confederation, the summit series that stole a nation's heart. But history isn't carved solely from grand moments. In every corner of this vast land, lesser-known tales linger. Forgotten heroes, struggles echoing in local lore, moments that shaped communities but faded from the national stage. This podcast is a journey of rediscovery. I'm no scholar, just a captivated explorer. My goal isn't to lecture, but to ignite. If my tales spark a flicker of curiosity in you, then I've succeeded. So settle in. Adventure awaits in the echoes of time. This is Canadian History with Stephen Wilson. In school, I remember the War of 1812 as being taught as having a few key reasons for its start, but it was mainly based around the war hawks like Henry Clay in the American Congress, who wanted to expand their nation to take over Canada. There's also other issues such as impressment. Really, the causes of the war were quite complex. A good number of factors went into the reasons why the United States declared war on Great Britain just under 30 years after the official end of the American Revolutionary War. When the Americans issued their declaration of war to start the War of 1812 on June 18th of that year, it came after years of issues that had built up and stoked the feelings of many that the Americans needed to assert themselves in defense of the grievances to not only restore their order, but show that they couldn't be pushed around. They were the new kids on the block and were trying to get their recognition from the major players in Europe. And at the start of the 19th century, there really was no more of a major player than Great Britain. One of the grievances the United States had was the British policy of impressment. Impressment was forced recruitment for the Royal Navy. The British would board a ship and forcibly recruit British subjects and deserters. The practice itself was first done in the 1600s and kept right through up until the early years of the 19th century. Where things became sticky was who was considered to be a British subject. Many nations, including Britain, considered anyone born as a subject of that country to be a British citizen, and therefore subject to impressment. American law, though, allowed people to claim citizenship after being a resident of that nation for a period. This meant many of the sailors were British under British law, but American under American law. wasn't helped by the fact that there was no such thing as official citizenship papers in the United States at the time. It was 1812. It's not like you could go down to a government office and get a passport like we do today. The viewpoint of the American government was if they were serving on an American ship, be it a merchant vessel or naval, they were a citizen of the United States. Meanwhile, British naval officers felt that serving on an American ship was a way for British deserters to hide, and they weren't really Americans. Now, there were some unofficial citizenship documents that were available for Americans, but those were considered by the British to be fraudulent and were treated as such. There was one incident around the issue of impressment which really whipped up a furor in the United States, and it is considered one of the key events in the lead-up to the war. The Chesapeake Leopard Affair happened on June 22, 1807. To set the scene, the British were at war with Napoleonic France. Two French warships were pursued by the British to Chesapeake Bay on the American Atlantic seaboard, and a task force had them hemmed in. While the British were blockading the French from leaving, some of the sailors from the Royal Navy deserted and were given sanctuary by local American officials. Some of these deserters even signed up with the United States Navy and were now on the USS Chesapeake, a 38-gun frigate. A letter was sent to the commander of the Gosport Navy Yard, Stephen Decatur, demanding that the Americans turn over three men who were said to have deserted from the HMS Melampus, one of the ships taking part in the blockade, keeping those French ships hemmed in. They alleged the men had signed on for the Chesapeake, which was being outfitted at the Washington Naval Yard for a trip to the Mediterranean. Written orders were also issued to the HMS Leopard to board and search the Chesapeake for any deserters from several British ships. The Chesapeake had set sail and was off the coast of Norfolk, Virginia, when the Leopard hailed it. The American ship welcomed an officer from the British vessel aboard, and a search warrant was presented. But after a short discussion, the British officer returned to his ship empty-handed. The British captain called on the Americans to submit, but the Chesapeake did not answer. A shot was fired across the bow, then a broadside from the Leopard. The captain would strike his colors and surrender. The attack had killed three and wounded 18. A boarding party then came onto the Chesapeake and took four men who they claimed to be deserters from the Royal Navy. There were, though, quite a few British nationals who were crew on the Chesapeake. Only one of the four seized was actually British-born. The other three were American residents who had previously been impressed to serve on British warships. The encounter sparked an outrage in the United States and called for a show of force in response. President Thomas Jefferson wrote at the time, "Never since the Battle of Lexington have I seen this country in such a state of exasperation as at present, and even that I not produce such unanimity." The United States demanded the return of the four seamen, the exclusion of British warships from American waters, and the cessation of impressment from vessels sailing under an American flag. Jefferson would look to diplomacy to try and calm the issue. The diplomacy would also see the Americans calling for an end to several of the orders of council that had been issued by Britain. These orders forbade trade between France and Great Britain and her allies in neutral countries. As well, the British Navy was to blockade France and called for all shipments to stop in English ports to be checked to make sure there was nothing on board that could be of aid to France. Any ships that did not check in at an English port were liable to be seized by the British Navy. The United States would put into place an embargo act of its own, passed by Congress in December of 1807, in part in response to the Chesapeake Leopard Affair, and in part in response to the orders in council that were being put out in Britain. This act placed an embargo on all ships and vessels under U.S. authority, which were prevented in obtaining clearance to travel to foreign ports. Merchant ships traveling between American ports needed to supply a surety, and, of course, warships were exempt from the provisions of the law. The law flat-out harmed the American economy in some areas, as ships sat idle. While the scarcity of European goods did help to stimulate American manufacturing, and the fact that trade with Britain could still happen through Canada, the embargo didn't seem to have the impacts that were desired. Nearly 200 years after the events, Douglas Irwin studied the impacts of the Embargo Act. He wrote in the Review of International Economics, quote, "A simple general equilibrium calculation suggests that the embargo cost about 5% of America's 1807 GNP, at a time when the trade share was about 13%, including domestic exports and shipping earnings. The welfare cost was lower than the trade share because the embargo did not eliminate trade, and because domestic producers successfully shifted production toward previously imported manufactured goods. The Embargo Act would be replaced by the Non-Intercourse Act in the waning days of the Jefferson presidency. This changed the embargo to apply to just American shipping heading to British and French ports. It, like the Embargo Act, was largely unenforceable. This was followed by Macon's Bill No. 2, which lifted the embargoes for 3 months. The bill stated that if France or Britain disrupted American shipping to the other country, an embargo would apply to them as well, unless they agreed to stop disrupting American shipping. This, too, was difficult to enforce, and while it was passed, it wasn't well received, particularly by American President James Madison. While there was diplomatic posturing taking place, other intrigues were happening in Canada. At least, there were intrigues believed to be happening. John Henry was a man who moved to Montreal from Massachusetts in 1807. He would find himself blending in with the polite society of the time, families like the McGills, Frobishers, and Richardsons. He would become fast friends with Herman Ryland, the civil secretary of the time. Henry wrote to Ryland about the political opinions in New England, the overarching theme of the correspondence. If war were to ever break out, New England would secede from the United States. By 1809, Sir James Craig, the Governor General of Canada, instructed Henry to gather information in the United States. Craig made numerous promises of rewards to Henry, including a position in Canada. Craig would die before any of that would come to fruition. The spy would head to London to meet with British officials, but didn't receive any of the awards he had been promised. He returned to the United States, where he met Paul-Émile Soubiran. Soubiran was a con artist who claimed to be Comte Édouard de Crillon. Soubiran suggested the letters and reports be taken to the President of the United States, as they could be a casus belli for the United States against Britain. Henry sold the documents in his possession to Madison, who paid $50,000 sight unseen. As part of the deal, another $40,000 was to be provided to Henry by Soubiran in the form of an ancestral estate in France. Henry would sail to France, where he found out that the Count de Crillon didn't exist, and neither did the estate. The letters, which supposedly exposed intrigues in New England, weren't more than likely complete fabrications by Henry. If they did hold any truths, they embellished the sentiment quite a bit. The hope to whip up more anti-British sentiment didn't come to fruition. Tensions with indigenous people were another factor that would lead to the War of 1812. The Americans were looking to expand, which led them into direct conflict with indigenous people in the Northwest Territory, now the states of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin. The indigenous people in that area were supplied with weapons by British traders in Canada. While the area had been ceded to the Americans in the Treaty of Paris to end the Revolutionary War, this was done without the consultation of the people who were living there and had lived there for years. The indigenous nations of the area rallied under Tenskwatawa. He was a Shawnee prophet and the brother of Tecumseh. Tenskwatawa called on indigenous people to reject European and American ways. This included not drinking alcohol, not wearing European-style clothing, and not using firearms. He also called on the nations to not cede land to the Americans. Tensions would lead to Tenskwatawa and Tecumseh to move to the confluence of the Wabash and Tippecanoe Rivers in present-day Indiana near Lafayette. While there, they were initially unwelcomed by the Miami people who lived in the region, but then they started to attract more and more followers from several indigenous nations. Tecumseh was seen as a leader of this confederacy, and the British asked him about forming an alliance. He would agree. Now, while this was happening, William Harrison, the governor of America's newly formed Indiana Territory, negotiated with other indigenous leaders of the area against the wishes of President Madison. Eventually, after 2 weeks of negotiating, the Treaty of Fort Wayne would be signed, and the United States gained over 3 million acres along the Wabash River. This treaty outraged Tecumseh. He advocated an ideal that had been held by other indigenous leaders, that the land was owned in common by all nations, and no land could be sold without agreement by all. Tecumseh called on warriors to abandon the chiefs who had signed the treaty and to join him at Prophetstown. He then traveled to Vincennes, the capital of Indiana Territory, to meet with the governor. Tecumseh insisted the Treaty of Fort Wayne was not valid, and he told the governor the Americans should not try to settle the land. Tensions continued to rise over the course of the next year. Tecumseh called on indigenous people to join his cause, writing, "Where today are the Pequot? Where are the Narragansett, the Mohican, the Poconet, and the other powerful tribes of our people? They have vanished before the avarice and oppression of the white man, as snow before the summer sun. Sleep not longer, O Choctaws and Chickasaws. Will not the bones of our dead be plowed up and their graves turned into plowed fields?" Tecumseh had traveled south to recruit more followers. In his absence, his brother, Tenskwatawa, would stir up those in Prophetstown even further. The governor of Indiana Territory would march his army from Vincennes along the Wabash River. On November 6, 1811, Harrison's army arrived outside the town, and Tenskwatawa agreed to meet him. Expecting Harrison to attack anyway, a preemptive strike was launched on the American force. The Americans would hold their ground and burn Prophetstown in the Battle of Tippecanoe. Tecumseh would secretly rebuild his alliance and would ally himself with the British in Canada, even though his goals were to secure indigenous independence. This goal aligned with the British desire to create a neutral buffer state of indigenous people between the Americans and themselves, even though much of the land had been ceded from British control to the Americans in 1783. It is worth noting, all these discussions about who controlled what part of the Northwest Territory were between the British and the Americans, without any discussion with the indigenous people who lived there. In some cases, they weren't even aware their land was claimed by another nation until those looking to settle on the land arrived. One of the last things to happen before the declaration of war was the assassination of British Prime Minister Spencer Perceval. The orders in council, some of which led to the war, would be repealed by the administration in London led by Lord Liverpool after Perceval's death. However, these orders in council were repealed on June 23, 1812, 5 days after the United States declared war, and just before the word of declaration arrived in London. While those orders in council were a contributing factor to the declaration of war, it isn't known for sure that if the word had gotten to the Americans in time, if it would have done anything to stop the war from taking place. Given that impressment was still happening, and the rancor in the United States Congress, it would have at best delayed the conflict. The call for the declaration of war came from a faction in the American Congress known as the War Hawks. This group was led, for the most part, by the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Henry Clay. Also part of the faction was South Carolina's John C. Calhoun. One of the other factors considered by some to the declaration of war was the desire by the Americans to annex Canada. This is where it is the most divisive as to what the intentions of the Americans were. It has been argued that the Americans looked to seize at least what is now Western Ontario from the British. Many Canadians at the time, and especially since, believed the expansionism was a driving factor in the start of the war. Now, in the American Congress, things were a little bit different. The Federalist Party was opposed to war and opposed to the annexation of Canada. Meanwhile, the other party, the Democratic Republicans, were split on the issue. One faction wanted to permanently expel the British from the continent and the annexation of their lands into the United States. The other part of the Democratic Republicans felt that the annexation of Canada would give too much power to the northern states. They were also opposed to the annexation of Canada as they felt its Catholic population would be counterintuitive to the ideals of the United States. Looking back through the lens of today, we can appreciate the irony of a nation that was founded upon guaranteeing the freedom of religion, finding a group of people unfit for citizenship based on their religious beliefs. When the war was declared, there was no mention of annexation, but there was support for it once the conflict was underway. There was an expectation that Upper Canada, what is now Ontario, would become part of the United States and the end of the war. Some do believe that the invasion of Canada was more of a bargaining chip at the negotiating table. After all, the British controlled the seas. It wasn't likely the Americans would be able to load up thousands of troops and sail to Britain to launch an invasion. There's also the situation of the inhabitants of Upper Canada. Many of them were exiled United Empire loyalists and recent immigrants. They were against the idea of American annexation. While the Americans thought the Canadians would greet the Americans as liberators, in most cases it was very much the opposite. The American House of Representatives would argue for 4 days in early June 1812 on whether they would declare war. they would vote 61% in favor of the declaration, and the Senate would vote 59% in favor of the war. The measure was signed into law by James Madison on June 18th. The declaration read, "Be it enacted by the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that war be, and the same is hereby declared, to exist between the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland and the dependencies thereof, and the United States of America and their territories, and that the President of the United States is hereby authorized to use the whole land and naval power of the United States to carry into the same effect, and to issue to private armed vessels of the United States commissions or letters of marque and general reprisal in such form as he shall think proper and under the seal of the United States against the vessels, goods, and effects of the government of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland and the subjects thereof." On June 30th, the declaration of war, along with the British ambassador to the United States, would leave New York City, arriving in Halifax 8 days later. It would be another 3 weeks before word had made its way to London. The commander of British forces in Upper Canada received word about the declaration of war much faster than his superiors. Isaac Brock wrote, "Whereas on the 17th day of June last, the Congress of the United States of America declared that war then existed between those states and their territories and the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland and the dependencies thereof. And whereas, in pursuance of such declarations, the subjects of the United States have actually committed hostilities against the possessions of His Majesty and the persons and property of his subjects in this province. Now, therefore, by and with the advice of His Majesty's Executive Council in the affairs of the province, I do hereby strictly enjoin and require all His Majesty's liege subjects to be obedient to the lawful authorities, to forbear all communication with the enemy or persons residing within the territory of the United States, and to manifest their loyalty by a zealous cooperation with His Majesty's armed force in defense of the province and repulse of the enemy, to be vigilant in the discharge of their duty, especially to prevent all communication with the enemy, and to cause all persons suspected of traitorous intercourse to be apprehended and treated according to law." This proclamation was written on July 6th. While issuing the proclamation, Brock ordered his forces to act against the Americans in northern Michigan, who were not even aware war had been declared. On July 17th, the first action of the war took place at Fort Mackinac. The fort was located at the western end of Lake Huron, on Mackinac Island. With aid from the Northwest Company and Indigenous allies, British Captain Charles Roberts would lead a force from Fort St. Joseph, southeast of present-day Sault Ste. Marie, roughly 80 kilometers to the east along the St. Mary's River, to Mackinac Island. They arrived at 3 in the morning on July 17th, and by 10 a.m., Roberts summoned the American commander of the fort, Lieutenant Porter Hanks, who he told of the state of war between the two nations, and demanded his surrender. Hanks was taken by surprise. He had around 60 men under his command, and the opposing force was around 200 soldiers. Fearing the indigenous warriors with the British would massacre his men, Hanks surrendered without a fight. The Americans would be paroled immediately after swearing they would not take up arms in the war again. The civilians on the island were made to swear an oath of allegiance to the United Kingdom. And thus, without a single shot fired, the War of 1812 was underway and would continue until February 1815. For the soldiers from Mackinac, they would go to Detroit, where Hanks would be charged for cowardice by his superiors. In one of the cruelest turns of fate during the war, before the trial could begin, Hanks would be killed during the siege of Fort Detroit when a cannonball went through the room where Hanks was standing. He would be bifurcated. The officer next to him killed as well. There is still a visible vestige of the time, aside from Mackinac Island Historical State Park, that the British occupied Fort Mackinac, that exists to this day. And it all has to do with winter. The British soldiers who were originally stationed at Fort St. Joseph had, at the beginning of the previous winter, requested a supply of winter greatcoats from headquarters in Montreal. The coats weren't available, so Captain Roberts came up with an ingenious solution. He got his hands on a large enough supply of Hudson's Bay Point blankets and got the keeper of the King's stores at the fort, John Askin Jr., to make enough greatcoats from the material for the men. Within 2 weeks, with the help of local women, the coats were made and would prove to be quite popular with the men. After capturing Fort Mackinac and occupying it, Roberts put in an order for more point blankets to make the greatcoats for more men who were expected to arrive. The blankets that arrived were primarily a black-on-red tartan pattern. The length was also shortened into a double-breasted style to make it easier for going through snow. And soon, orders would start arriving for the creation of the jacket from across the frontier. And the Mackinaw jacket, which is now well known for being the attire of the stereotypical lumberjack or grunge enthusiast, would come to be. And so our journey through this chapter of the War of 1812 ends. In our next episode, we will look at the beginnings of the war, including the American landings in Upper Canada, the Siege of Detroit, and a look at who Sir Isaac Brock was, the man who earned the nickname the Hero of Upper Canada, thanks to his actions in the early stages of the war, as well as the lead up to it. Thank you for traveling alongside me. If these stories sparked a question, a memory, or just a newfound fascination, keep the conversation going. Share your thoughts in the comments. Subscribe for more Hidden Histories, and give us a like if you enjoyed the ride. Thank you for listening to Canadian History with Stephen Wilson.